Here we are. Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Defiance Weekly Recap. So excited for this one. So we have a couple of new guests. So our guest for today is Pete Rizzo, editor at Bitcoin Magazine, also longtime journalist friend, colleague at ACJR. So great to have you here, Pete. We'll be talking about Bitcoin Ordinals, so super excited for that. We also have Jeremy Nation, our newest reporter, joining the Defiant crew. So welcome, Jeremy, and welcome to your first weekly recap, first of many. And we have YYC Trader, our DGEN-in-chief and head of news, and myself, the founder of the Defiant. Owen is out today, so come back next week to see the whole crew minus Sam, who, as you guys know, is in Australia. So with that, before we get to ordinals, we'll be talking about other headlines in the second part of the show. We'll be talking markets, the entire market rallying after the debt ceiling deal. We'll be talking liquid staking tokens, ecosystem just building up. It's looking to be the theme of the summer in DeFi. We'll be giving an update on the multi-chain CEO gone missing and how that's causing ripples across the space. Uniswap traders are at an all-time high, driven by meme coin mania. And we have some NFT drama. That's kind of an ongoing theme on our podcast. So stay tuned for all of that. But yeah, let's talk ordinals. Pete, so we were kind of discussing, just how surprising this phenomenon has been for Bitcoin. So if you can just, maybe take a step back and to get on the same page, maybe just explain what these type of tokens are, like technically how they're able to be issued on Bitcoin, and then we can kind of dive deeper.
Yeah, sure. First, thanks for having me. As a Bitcoiner, I know that I'm a bit sort of a stranger in these parts, but, I think bear markets are a great chance to reevaluate assumptions. One of the reasons I'm here is that, as you said, because of the Ordinals protocol, I think a lot of people in the crypto space or NFT space have been reevaluating Bitcoin. They're coming to it for the first time. They're open to learning about it. I think the great thing in the bear market is we're seeing a lot of the narrative assumptions kind of break down on either side. So, yeah, with Ordinals, I think it's super fascinating. One of the, things that I kind of, or assumptions that I think in the last market that I was excited to see break down is this idea that, we have crypto assets, right? Like Bitcoin is just kind of this dumb gold rock. And then maybe we have these other chains that do kind of like more exciting things. One of the things that I think is interesting is Ordinals sort of punctured that kind of reality, right? Now we have Bitcoin essentially acting as a platform for these other markets where traditionally we would have thought we might have needed kind of an infrastructure like an Ethereum, Solana to do that. When in reality, now we can do that kind of on Bitcoin, on the base layer of the blockchain, with potentially some greater protections and some different features than we had before. So, what is Ordinals? It's a new protocol. It was launched in January 2023 by a solo developer by the name of Casey Rotemore. Who does consider himself a Bitcoin maximalist, right? He's someone who thinks that Bitcoin is the best money, the best, kind of crypto financial system that we're building. And, he really saw what was going on in the NFT world and he was seeing all these exciting art projects. And he was saying, how can I make this technology better, right? Or in his view, right? How can I make it something where I feel comfortable, with people using this technology to issue their art? Because, one of his frustrations as being a ETH Solana user at the time was essentially, with IPFS and these other structures, you usually have to host your data elsewhere, right? So there's this kind of dynamic where, and you saw this, I think, during the market mania of 2021, where people were buying NFTs. Sometimes they would go missing. Like sometimes the data availability wasn't great. So Ordinals was essentially built to solve that problem where, what we're doing here is that you're embedding arbitrary data within Bitcoin transactions. Specifically, you're doing that in what's called the witness data. So this is essentially kind of a part of the 4 megabyte block that Bitcoin produces every 4 minutes that's reserved for sort of like more complex scripting contracts. So if you're familiar with like Miniscript and some of these things that Bitcoiners are doing that is a bit more advanced, this is like with multi-party contracts, insurance, and things like that. So this was something that was kind of carved out for that. He decided to use it for you know, NFTs or storing digital art, and essentially launched this protocol within a few weeks. You know, I think there was 1 million inscriptions that were done on Bitcoin. I was just talking with Jeremy about, you know, my wake up moment, which is essentially, you know, just in the midst of evaluating this new technology, like as a Bitcoiner and somebody who, you know, contributes to the conversation, you're always trying to kind of evaluate new protocols, how they work. Are they good for Bitcoin in terms of like, you know, are they adding positively to our mission and goal, and do they work with the technology? So yeah, it was just explosive. You know, I had to get down there in the actual Discords and just see for myself. And I, you know, within a week I had joined 200 distinct projects, somewhere with, you know, 500 to a couple thousand users. And it was very clear to me that there was real demand for this, right? So there was essentially people who were saying, yes, you know, we think Bitcoin can solve some of these problems. And yeah, it was just amazing to see how quickly they were experimenting, right? And in terms of like, you know, what they were bringing, what they were doing. I think you saw a lot of auctions, but, you know, even then it was pretty early, right? There was some denominating, you know, their trades in ETH and some in Bitcoin. So there's just this huge culture clash. And, you know, my big wake up moment was, okay, you know, this is a new technology. It's seeking to solve problems. It seems like it has a strong product market fit. And then, you know, from a Bitcoin magazine standpoint, it's like, what can we do to help educate these users? Because, you know, they don't understand Bitcoin wallets. They don't know what a Lightning wallet is. They don't know how to sign a previously signed Bitcoin transaction and execute an auction. So it was a tremendous like education opportunity, right? So I think putting aside some of the theoretical discussion, which I think is, of course, still valid, there was a market opportunity, right? People were interested in Bitcoin for the first time. And I think, you know, my moment was like, hey, this is a great chance to educate them, because, you know, as we move forward in kind of this whole crypto space, you know, I think we don't really know everything about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies yet. And I think, you know, I'm excited by figuring out what does the world look like where, you know, some of the markets that we've traditionally associated with, quote, smart contract blockchains, living on Bitcoin and then competing, you know, on different blockchains, right? Essentially, now we do have Bitcoin with one of the largest NFT markets, and it's growing the fastest, right? So what does the world look like where different cryptocurrencies have different competing markets, and Bitcoin is a player in that? So,
yeah, I think, you know, this has been such a remarkable rise. It's been so fast. Like, we reported on Ordinals surpassing 1 million inscriptions back in April. 1 month later, we're already at 10 million. Yeah, 10 million. And here you see how, you know, it's been really an exponential rise. So here it's inscriptions over time with 10 million here. Fees earned by the protocol. And then here we have the top NFT projects by, I think, volume sales. And crazy to see a Bitcoin NFT topping this ranking, you know, which has traditionally been occupied by Ethereum NFTs or like other, like you were saying, other smart contract chains. So I think it's, you know, this like Ordinals bursting into the scene has really shattered some preconceptions of what Bitcoin can do. Like, I think everyone kind of assumed Bitcoin is just digital gold. It's just, you know, this hard money, like that's what it's good at. But here we're seeing, you know, other types of use cases exploding on it. So it's been really surprising.
Yeah. And I think it's just the tip of the iceberg, right? I think, you know, one of the things that I think people are really underselling about what happened with Ordinals is I think it just sent a tremendous signal to the entire crypto market of, okay, here's the prize of building on Bitcoin, right? If you are able to bring one of these markets over to Bitcoin, because I think, you know, especially as I talk to the cryptocurrency users, you know, from other ecosystems, you know, they acknowledge that Bitcoin has this kind of gold standard aura, right? They understand the fervor and the mania around why people are, you know, kind of die hard into Bitcoin and, you know, maybe don't like, you know, some of these other platforms, right? When you talk about the advantages of Bitcoin with, you know, proof of work, kind of what Satoshi did, the 21 million cap in terms of monetary policy, right? There's all these things that I think, you know, most people know. But now we're seeing, okay, well, you know, Casey Rotemer, the inventor of Ordinals, right? He comes out and creates this protocol and it just kind of cracks those perceptions, right? I think a lot of people who are coming over, they legitimately didn't know or even think you could do NFTs on Bitcoin. And I think that's going to kind of spark the question of, okay, does Bitcoin start competing for the stablecoin market? Does it start competing for some of these kind of over-collateralized distributed lending markets? And do you see kind of separate builders, right, who are inspired by Casey, who essentially said, you know, look, I want to be the next guy who kind of goes out and does that. But I also think it's important to kind of talk a little bit about, you know, Casey as a person and what he did as a builder, right? Because one of the things that we've seen in the, you know, kind of broader crypto markets is generally when somebody releases a protocol like this, you know, there is a token, there's a foundation, there's some type of entity that is, you know, kind of exorbitantly benefiting from that. In this case, you know, you ask like what token is, you know, kind of powering this. In this case, there is no token, right? So one of the things that Ordinals does that's pretty clever is it just creates a scheme for kind of ordering Bitcoins, right? So we know there's 21 million Bitcoins, so you can kind of order them from zero to 21 million. And then because you can order them with this protocol, you can associate data with them, right? So this is a person who, you know, there is no exorbitant kind of gain for Casey Rodemar. His prize is that he brought this market to Bitcoin and this innovation, but we're seeing like what that unlocks in terms of just like overall market potential, right? So in a sense, you can kind of look at him as someone who like, you know, and this is how I would view it, is that I think the prize for people bringing these kind of schemes over is going to be doing it in a way where it actually drives value to the Bitcoin holder, right? Because this is the theory of like, okay, well, why do you want to build things without tokens? Why are they potentially negative, right? In this case, Casey invented something. What he invented is bringing this market to Bitcoin, and he's not kind of disproportionately benefiting from that. Maybe the people who are buying individual ordinals.
But do you think this will boost Bitcoin price? Like, because there's more activity on the chain, there's more, you know, I don't know, fees being generated for miners. Well, I would argue like
that is what has been the thesis for the smart contract chains for a long time, right? Is
for
that
sure.
Essentially, yeah. That activity will add the value. So I'd have to almost have to like kind of re-ask that question back. It's like, I think so, right? I don't know if we as like a whole cryptocurrency builder ecosystem know that question, but I think at some point it has to, right? Because, you know, we've seen Solana became a venue for that and Solana price went up. We saw Ethereum obviously was the original venue where a lot of this stuff was built, and its price, you know, went up. So I think, you know, if Bitcoin does start competing for these markets and it does start winning some of these markets, I'd be hard pressed to say that's not good for Bitcoin, because, you know, what are these people doing, right? They're buying and selling Bitcoin, because you have to buy ordinals denominated in Bitcoin. The ordinals themselves are backed by a piece of Bitcoin, right? So when I have an ordinal, usually they're connected to like 10,000 sats, right? So at the end of the day, you know, and this is kind of one of the things that really kind of flipped me into the camp of being like, oh, ordinals are interesting, is, you know, if that NFT goes to zero, you know, 100 years or 50 years, 20 years, whatever, you still have 10,000 sats, right? Which you can spend just as if they were regular sats. So one of the cool things is, you know, you have a big art collection on Bitcoin, goes to zero. Maybe in 100 years, the block reward is 37 sats. And, you know, you've got a million sats that you bought from NFTs, but they're still Bitcoin, right? So this is where we talk about, you know, ordinals as a design scheme and the assurances they provide to users, right? Because I think that's where on the Bitcoin magazine side, you know, we sort of found ourselves asking like, okay, Ordinal seems like it's solving problems for people, right? It has these like technical attributes that are, you know, actually better for users, right? Where if you're a person, you know, let's just say whatever you think about NFTs, right? People are buying and selling them. So if people are buying and selling things, I think you have to say it's the responsible thing to make sure they're doing that with the highest degree of security, regardless of what you think about it. Even if you think that NFTs have no value, maybe that's your opinion, but I still think that if there are going to be people doing that, it's we would want those people to do that in a way where there's like the maximum benefit to them, right? So there's actually market problems that we can help solve here. And I think that Ordinals did kind of solve, right? It actually, the provenance of the data is much better. It's secured by the Bitcoin blockchain. And if you have a high degree of confidence that the blockchain will be accessible in, you know, 100, 200 years, that means you're crypto dick butt like will be available depending on how many people are, you know, running ordinals. You know, it might not be valuable, but it'll be there, right? So I think again, like when you think about, you know, why was the uptick in ordinals kind of, you know, so large? And again, I think it really solved real problems in the market. And I'm excited to see that there are crypto builders, Bitcoin builders who are now just saying like, okay, let's put our differences aside. Let's actually make this a better product, right? So with Bitcoin Magazine, we actually issued an ordinals collection. We took our, you know, 21 original magazines, we took the covers, and, you know, we did an auction. And we did an auction where, you know, we were able to let people bid on these using pre-signed Bitcoin transactions, which essentially, like, you know, we said, hey, anyone who bids this price at this time will buy it. We broadcast those transactions. and they were able to just kind of instantly buy it without, you know, kind of worrying about an escrow agent or somebody in the middle. Like, this was a, you know, a trust minimized auction where we sold the digital good. We know that that digital good will be on the blockchain forever. Like, if you own Bitcoin Magazine cover one, you will always have that. You'll be able to cryptographically prove that you own it. And you're able to buy it in a way where you didn't need to trust anybody. There was no one who could potentially rug you. It was us saying, hey, we're going to sign a transaction. We're going to broadcast it. If you sign it as the buyer, you're the owner. And again, this is secured on Bitcoin. And Bitcoin, again, is a system that, you know, I would say, like, even people in the crypto space I've talked to is like, there's a high degree of confidence that Bitcoin will be around, you know, for a long time at this point. So
I mean, to summarize the difference of a Bitcoin NFT versus, say, an Ethereum NFT, to you, like, the big innovation is the data availability. Like, the data is
in the blockchain. So what you're doing when you mint an ordinal is you're broadcasting a transaction, and you're including the data for the actual art image, like, in that transaction. This is the witness data. And so that transaction is broadcast to all the nodes, and all the nodes verify that transaction, which means all the nodes also still store the corresponding data, right? So they actually correspond, like, store the ones and zeros, whatever, that make up your dick butt, you know, if you want to use that analogy. And then what's interesting about this, because the way Bitcoin is designed, is that the nodes, like the people running the actual software, you can discard that data. Like, the nodes don't need to keep it. They can validate it, but they can discard it, right? So if you are someone who's running a node at home, yes, you're getting pushed much more data now, right? So your node at home, you know, you can look at the kind of growth of the UTXO set and the growth of the blockchain itself and see that it's growing much faster, or, you know, a good degree percentage-wise, like 10 to 20% faster, I would probably say. But, you know, these node operators can discard that data. There's no reason that you need to keep it as a regular Bitcoin user. So that's kind of interesting because, you know, again, when you think about systems design, one of the things when you're building something for Bitcoin is, you know, Bitcoiners or Bitcoin maximalists, like, you know, we take the view that Bitcoin is going to be a software that runs in perpetuity. So, like, in 100, 200 years, we're trying to think about how people are using Bitcoin. So this is when you see, like, the real alarm around it, right?
And then the second difference was it that these NFTs, like, are they, you said they're backed by sats? Like,
by actual Bitcoin. So essentially, in order to send that transaction, right, you have to kind of assign which Satoshi. So one of the interesting things with the Bitcoin is that there are Satoshis from the Bitcoin standpoint, but really there's UTXOs, and UTXOs are created and destroyed every transaction. So what the Ordinals protocol does is it creates this kind of defined Satoshi. It numbers it from, like, 1 to, you know, 0 to 21 million, and then it associates the data with that. But again, because it's an actual Satoshi, you know, it's this data is associated with some set of Satoshis. So in some cases, it could be as small as 1. So, you know, the person who bought the issue number 1 Bitcoin magazine, they have 1 Satoshi that is inscribed with that, you know, with that image. In the case of other, you know, kind of ordinals, sometimes it's as many as, like, 10,000. Right. So that you can have it's a kind of an arbitrary set. Right. You can any kind of number of Satoshis you can just kind of ascribe or associate that data with, you know, and it's your choosing.
The creator. OK, the creator chooses how many Satoshis they want to inscribe.
I think it depends also on the minting service. Right. So this is one of the things that's happening in the market that's, like, a bit, like, inconsistent. So I don't think there's a standardness, but, like, the minimum is, like, at least you're getting one Satoshi. So you're getting an image.
Okay.
So image is tied to the Satoshi. Yeah.
And so if, like, the price on the secondary market of your NFT goes to 0, at least you have the Satoshis backing it.
Yeah, that's one of the more creative arguments, I think, right? Because I think one of the things that I think a lot of people on the kind of the Bitcoin side are more critical of, like, the NFT market over the last few years, it's essentially, like, you know, you're seeing these exorbitant prices, but the data that is actually in that NFT, it's, like, not stored in the actual, you know, chain in many cases. Sorry. Yeah, it's, like, all on some, like, random server or whatever. And then, like, you're not actually getting, you don't own any, like, Ether corresponding Solana, like, there's nothing, you know, you're not actually, there's nothing for you to take away. So, like, the interesting thing with the ordinals is, like, you know, at the very least that this person will own some amount of Bitcoin, right? And by today's value, maybe that's not that much. But if you take a really long kind of term view on it, you know, one of the fascinating things I think is like, you know, imagine you have an art collection, it doesn't go well, but like, you know, you can sell the Satoshis, and then in the future, if Bitcoin is, you know, super valuable, then those Satoshis are still valuable, right? So it's a little bit of a hedge, and I think it drives value back to Bitcoin, like in a very creative way, right? So and these are some of the features that I think when people were looking at ordinals kind of originally and assessing it, it was one, it's like, okay, it solves the state of availability problem for the NFT market. It kind of creates this like data, you know, requirement for Bitcoin. But then if we look at like what that data requirement is, it's probably as minimal as it could be. Does that mean it's like the best case scenario, right? There are a lot of people concerned about how much data we are adding to the Bitcoin blockchain. And there's, you know, some things you can talk about that. And then there's this idea of like, okay, well, you know, is owning this ordinal like better than another NFT, and kind of apples to oranges, like comparing it, you know, it's backed by real Bitcoin. And because of that, you know, you can imagine a situation where there's, you know, a really big hype cycle around these and a lot of people are trading them, you know, they're both denominating those buys and sells in Bitcoin and exchanging Bitcoin, but you know, they're actually, the art that they're trading is Bitcoin also, which is pretty cool.
And you know, the ordinals.
Some questions also... for...
Oh,
go ahead, go Jerry, ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, it's interesting to see that it's introduced a new layer of programmability into the blockchain, so that developers that were, you know, iterating on the Ethereum side or on the Solana side or where their smart contracts were available to develop in can now turn to Bitcoin and say, hey, look, I want to build here. And that could cause a great proliferation of applications and different use cases on the foundational chain that started all of this, almost like a full circle.
That's one way of looking at it. I think people are, you know, certainly going to be interested to see like what else comes from this. And that's why I say, like, for me, ordinals is almost just a signal, right? It's essentially, it breaks this mental model that we all had that I just don't think was very accurate. And then the mental model was essentially like Bitcoin was this kind of dumb digital gold rock, and these other kind of application blockchains, like we needed to kind of make the sacrifices in terms of monetary policy, in terms of like other things, in order to have kind of this general creativity. And so now we're left, which I think is like a more correct mental model, which is that, you know, any blockchain or cryptocurrency of significant size, like, is its own economy. And essentially these economies are competing. And you know, when people ask me about the ordinals market, it's almost like, I think if a market was moving, let's just say manufacturing was moving from like Mexico to the United States, it's like an industry is kind of like migrating, right? Like, and I think it's interesting to think about, you know, these cryptocurrencies as economies that have other markets on them. And, you know, again, because Bitcoin is already kind of as a money has such a high market share and a high confidence, you know, okay, well, what happens if these markets that have kind of previously kind of used these other chains, well, you know, Bitcoin users, well, you know, maybe there's a big prize in kind of bringing this, some of this stuff back to Bitcoin. I think that's what Casey showed. It's, you know, developing something on Bitcoin may be more difficult, but you know that it's going to be used for potentially, you know, tens, if not hundreds of years. You know that there's kind of the diehard base there, and you know that you are, you know, he succeeded at bringing something to Satoshi's invention, right? Like in a way that like was previously thought impossible. And I think that's why it's important to kind of champion him also as like an inventor and a creator, because I think a lot of people don't understand that Bitcoin has really just had a high bar, you know, for innovation and why, right? And it's because we want Bitcoin to be available. We think that it's the best chance we have at a kind of a denationalized money that's decentralized and open to everybody. And so it's not impossible to do these things. It's just very, very, very hard. And I think what Casey...
But there were like developments that allowed this to happen, right? Like that weren't present before. Is that right? Like Taproot, or like there were other kind of updates to Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's the conventional narrative. So if you talk to some smart developers, they'll say that this was possible in different ways. The thing that actually changed what you could do in this specific case is that, you know, Segregated Witness, which was a soft fork upgrade to Bitcoin in 2017, increased the block size to 4 megabytes. Mm-hmm. And so prior to that, you could insert arbitrary data into Bitcoin this is sort of like, there's both what the developers building it say you can do, and then there's what's possible, right? And there's always a dissonance between these things. So anyway, in 2017, the block size was raised to 4 megabytes. But at that time, there was this function called opreturn, and opreturn had a limit on the amount of data that could be stored in a Bitcoin transaction, and it was about 80 bytes, which was about the size of a hash. So the Bitcoin developers were saying, like, okay, if you want to put arbitrary data in a Bitcoin, we're going to give you enough space for like a hash, but no more. And so Segregated Witness goes and increases the block size. Taproot comes ahead and it adds sort of this kind of witness, you know, expressivity to the witness data in terms of like what you can do with it. And so now all of a sudden we have a developer who comes along and says, oh, hey, I can move this arbitrary data over here. And rather than, you know, us being limited to 80 bytes, now you can do 4 megabytes. So when the Taproot wizards come out and they do their 4 megabyte, you know, NFT art, this is the actual file size is 4 megabytes. So the file size is taking the whole block. The block is 4 megabytes. That's the data size. And again, yeah, there's always, and this is, I think, what's interesting about Bitcoin and just cryptocurrency systems in general, right? There's always kind of the state of the art theory of like what people think is possible and like kind of accept as the current state. And then there's what you can do as an innovator, right? In terms of like changing that. So, you know, there were always different ways that this was attempted. And, you know, this was just the most successful we've seen. And because this data limitation is essentially, you know, kind of changed how we can add data to the blockchain, I think we'll see other people creating within this window. And I think it's going to be exciting to see what they create. Because, again, I do think there are markets that exist on Ethereum and Solana where, you know, even as someone who's not super confident in those chains, like there are real users there, right? So I'm not going to go out and say that there aren't people using stablecoins. There are. It's a big market, right? People are using them to transact, and they're really important, especially in areas where, you know, kind of onboarding and offboarding people to the banking system is very hard, right? So now we can take a look at these markets that have existed kind of in other chains and say, okay, like maybe there is another Casey out there who's going to think about the best way to bring that back to Bitcoin. And maybe his idea is going to have, you know, this next kind of step increase in the state of the art. So, right. So, you know,
together with like NFTs, we saw like BRC20s, right? Mm-hmm. Like kind of imitating ERC20s, and that could give way to like stable coins on Bitcoin potentially.
Yeah, BRC20 is interesting. I think there's a little bit less of a kind of great argument for BRC20 as like it's going to be the token standard, like kind of in the future. I think one of the reasons for that is Bitcoin block space, it's still a scarce resource. And with BRC20s, the way that it mints tokens is just very inefficient from a block space buying perspective. So, you know, you have seen these heavy conjecture periods of Bitcoin because people have been minting these tokens. And then at the end of the day, it's like you still have the question of like, well, even if you can create a token on Bitcoin, you still have to have some utility on it. So personally, you know, I'm more excited about kind of these upper levels. I think there was a question about Lightning Network where, you know, there's a standard that's been developed called Taproot Assets that's, you know, been in development with some Bitcoin developers for a long time. It should come out later this year. You know, I think there'll be a competition among different kind of like asset issuance protocols for Bitcoin, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I like to view these things as what's happened is we've got rid of these mental models. We're increasing our understanding of what's happening with Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. And I like to think that Ordinals kind of sent a signal and a challenge to people where, you know, someone was able to build something that was previously thought impossible. He was able to bring this market, which was successful elsewhere, to Bitcoin. And you'd like to think that, you know, that's an accomplishment that is going to drive more people to that.
Diego has an interesting question that I actually didn't know about this. Apparently there's a staking
sounds pretty new.
Token.
Yeah, this is the thing. I think you're just going to see a ton of different standards, right? In terms of what can people do. And I think that's why we're going to see a big experimentation, you know, with these things, because, you know, are any of these things going to be kind of the lasting solution? Like even with Ordinals, right? One of the things about Ordinals as a protocol is it also, as a buyer of block space, is a bit inefficient, right? So if we imagine a future where, you know, a few billion people are using Bitcoin daily, they're going to be sending a lot of transactions, and the transactions that they send are likely going to be, you know, maybe around 4 megabytes, like every 10 minutes. So then what happens with Ordinals, right? In this case, the way that Casey designed it is actually interesting because Ordinals are kind of like the buyer of last resort on the blockchain, right? So they're essentially deprioritized when when miners and nodes are looking at transactions. Essentially what they're looking for is economic density of the transactions, right? So it's actually, even during periods of high congestion on Bitcoin, when, you know, Ordinals was kind of driving the sats for Vbyte up into like 500, if you were sending just a regular Lightning transaction or a regular kind of withdrawal transaction, usually you confirmed within an hour. And this was because he designed it so that Ordinals transactions were like a bit more deprioritized. And will they be deprioritized into just being impossible to do on Bitcoin? Maybe. Maybe you do see NFTs do need to move to a higher layer. But the interesting thing with ordinals then is then that means we exist in a time period where it might be actually a real rare opportunity to mint a digital artifact or an ordinal on Bitcoin. And if that window does close, it actually might make the ordinals that you do have more valuable. Maybe. I mean, again, these are some of these things are theoretical.
I mean, if this does pan out and we see like different kind of token types being issued on Bitcoin and the Bitcoin blockchain becoming more congested, then it does make sense that, you know, it follows a similar trajectory to Ethereum, where you see this, you know, proliferation of layer two networks that are just needed to scale all these use cases.
Yeah, I think we're definitely seeing that, right? So Bitcoin has had a pretty well-developed and I would say, like, you know, pretty successful layer two with Lightning, right? In terms of, you know, you being able to sell and send payments. I think one of the cool things has been, you know, kind of watching some of the new crypto users. I think I was in one Slack channel where these, you know, kids were downloading Lightning wallets for the first time. And they were like, wow, this is as fast as Solana. And I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. I would have, you know, I've never used Solana, but that's an interesting, you know, it does work really fast. Lightning transactions, you know, go really fast. But yeah, I think we will see, and I'm excited to see the people who have thought through interesting kind of layer two concepts, you know, on other crypto protocols say like, oh, hey, maybe there's a bigger prize in me bringing this over
maybe
to Bitcoin.
There's a like roll-up solution for Bitcoin.
Right. Yeah. Eric Wall has been a big proponent for that. And I think a lot of Bitcoin developers are excited to kind of think through that idea. But again, I think it's like, I don't think we're specifically at the point where any of these things are, we can know whether they're going to be successful in the future. I just think we now know that there's a competition that's going to come. And why is it coming? Well, it's because, you know, after 14 years, Bitcoin is still kind of the biggest and most widely used cryptocurrency. It hasn't been assailed by, you know, any of these or overtaken by any of these competitors. We're now seeing it kind of develop some of these characteristics that I think a lot of people who, you know, from the 2017 to 21 era, you know, personally, I think they were told a lot of things about like that Bitcoin couldn't do this or wouldn't be able to do this that I don't think were entirely very accurate. And I'm excited to see what happens when they start to look at Bitcoin and you know, just providing their expertise. Again, I don't know the answers. I think I'm excited to get them involved in the discussion. You know, Bitcoin has a pretty active developer chat on the mailing list, which I think, you know, is always good to plug into. And there is a whole culture of, you know, Bitcoin development, right? This idea that Bitcoin has stagnated or that it hasn't been developed, you know, isn't true. There's been a couple upgrades to Bitcoin, one in 2017, one in 2021, that has improved the capabilities. And I still think we're just scratching the surface of what can happen with Bitcoin. Even if you're just talking about financial transactions, you know, some of the stuff that's going on with Miniscript, you know, in terms of what you can do with Bitcoin in terms of the programmability. You know, I was at Bitcoin Miami. I was watching developers, you know, walk me through like multi-party insurance contracts that you might be able to deploy on Bitcoin in the near future, where if you lose your Bitcoin, you actually get paid out Bitcoin like in a fairly trust minimized way, you know, by using kind of the service. So, you know, again, I think like it's tempting to like, you know, say like this building, right? Like, you know, all the stuff that we've built on cryptocurrency so far, like, I don't think it's all useful, but like some of it is, right? And I think some of the stuff that is good and useful in those markets coming back to Bitcoin, I think is exciting. And I'd personally like to live in a world where I think that's like the gold standard, right? And like for you to be the person who like builds something on Bitcoin, brings it to Bitcoin, and you know that people are going to be able to use it forever and it's going to drive value to that money. I think that's a powerful story to me. And I think it gets us out of the, you know, kind of chicken and egg problem that I think you had with other cryptocurrencies before, where it's like, you know, if you have that good of an idea, why not just launch your own blockchain and have your own token? Which I think why we saw like, you know, the Ethereum founders, they all ended up with their own blockchains. They all had their own token because there isn't the, you know, incentive that drives everybody back to the main thing, right? You ended up with like Ethereum, let's be real, Polkadot and Ethereum and, you know,
Cardano,
right? Yeah. You ended up with all these chains. And a lot of people who could be driving value to the same system are not, right? So I think it's interesting if Bitcoin can help solve that problem, right? By saying like, okay, yes, if we can bring this stuff to Bitcoin, that's the big prize. It drives value to Bitcoin. And then you don't have this problem that we had where there's, you know, a billion different crypto economies competing and, you know, they're all kind of fairly similar. So,
yeah,
built vaults on Bitcoin.
Vaults?
No, I'm not kidding. I'm looking at the Bitcoin dev chat right now.
Yeah, UpVault. Well, UpVault is an interesting proposal. I mean, that's specifically around you know, some of the custodianship, like essentially, you know, thinking through how we can secure Bitcoin in different ways. Because, right, you know, there has been a lot more of the development on Bitcoin in terms of like making stuff secure in perpetuity with like multi-sig contracts and things like that. But a lot of those providers now, I don't know if you're familiar with a service like Casa, where you would have like a 3 of 5 multi-sig and then, you know, secure Bitcoin that way. Like, you're still trusting a service provider. So there's a lot of proposals that would kind of, you know, essentially allow the same kind of schemes, but potentially get rid of the kind of intermediary that's currently needed for that. So yeah, those are really exciting too. Obviously those require like a consensus change in Bitcoin. So there would potentially need to be a soft fork for Upvault, but I think there's a lot of people who are excited about covenants in general and just, you know, what we can do with that design pattern. I don't know if that's too Bitcoin specific, but that's a whole rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Awesome. This is super, super interesting. I agree. It's a really exciting time for Bitcoin. I think the most, to me personally, the most exciting that I've seen kind of, you know, since covering the space. So yeah, we'll definitely, you know, be keeping track of all the new developments emerging. And yeah, I don't know, Jeremy, why we see if you guys have more questions for Pete or otherwise. We should cover all the other stuff that what happened in crypto this week.
Certainly, let's move ahead.
Well, all right, is that it for me?
I think we covered everything, actually.
Yeah, that was awesome. Thanks so much.
Cool. Pete. Well, I'll just do a short plug. You know, appreciate you, everybody listening to me. Again, editor of Bitcoin Magazine, Forbes contributor. You know, again, if you want to understand why people are building in Bitcoin and kind of understand the Bitcoin culture, check out Bitcoin Magazine. You know, lots of guides and resources. You know, come with an open mind. Again, I think that bear markets are a chance to reevaluate assumptions. If this is your first bear market, I'm sorry. You know, often what happens is you've come in, you've been told that things are a certain way and that they're always going to be that way and that we're going to pump forever if you just keep believing that. And that's unfortunately not true. These are the chances where this is the time where you have to kind of build forward, move ahead. You know, I think Bitcoin has a lot to offer to you developers and new users. And yeah, check out my work on Bitcoin Magazine. So appreciate you guys.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
And we'll have to have you guys on Bitcoin Magazine. So we got to get rid of this cultural division.
More Bitcoin Magazine Defiant collabs. I love this.
Awesome.
Cultures. All right, combining.
Guys. Thank you.
Great to see you, Pete. Bye. Really great.
Awesome. That was super fun. I really like Pete. I like how he's like so knowledgeable about Bitcoin, can explain things really well. So that was a good chat. Okay, so moving on, YYC, you want to talk markets?
Sure, I can just do a quick run through. So we had a couple of developments on the macroeconomic front. One was the debt ceiling bill that was finally passed through the Senate. So that's basically driven the stock markets up. The NASDAQ is at a one-year high. The S&P at the highest level since August of last year. So as we can see, you know, the stock markets have like taken off, but crypto's kind of been left behind. And earlier this morning, we had the jobs report as well, which came in way above expectations. 339,000 jobs created in the US versus an expectation of 190. The one, I guess, since we're in this, you know, bad news is good news kind of part of the cycle, because, you know, everyone's watching to see what the Fed is going to do next. And they've said they're going to be data dependent. And this kind of data showing that the economy is still doing well just gives them license to keep hiking, right? One thing to note here is that the unemployment rate finally ticked up. It's been, you know, trending lower, as you can see from this chart. But it ticked up from 3.5 to 3.7%. And that was enough to completely flip the rate probabilities for the June meeting. So a week ago, 65% chance of a hike, a 25 basis point hike. As of today, that's completely flipped. So 66% chance of no hike and 33% say still another point, 25 basis points. Wow. So it just goes to tell you, you know, every data point that comes out, like the markets are on a hair trigger, you know, like what's the Fed going to do next? And in terms of, it's been a broad-based rally today. as you can see, right? Almost all stocks are up except telecom. And that's just because Amazon announced that they might be rolling out, or they didn't announce it, but I think like this is the speculation that Amazon is getting into the mobile game for Prime users in the US. So, yeah. I mean, any industry that Amazon sets its eyes on gets scared.
Gonna be right? A monster. So, yeah.
Yeah, you can see T-Mobile, Verizon, all down. And in terms of crypto, like I said, still hasn't caught up to stocks. That correlation's kind of broken down this year, right? We've reported on that a few times. Bitcoin hovering about 27K, ETH around 1900. Pretty much the same level we've been at all week. In terms of other coins, Arbitrum's up quite a bit, 7.6%. Aptos as well. Optimism, that's another story that we were looking at. I'm going to stop sharing my screen so that I think, Cammy, you could possibly bring that up. The one about the token unlocks.
Yeah, one second. Optimism.
Yeah, so a lot of people expected that, you know, OP would just tank because the circulating supply was set to nearly double on the 30th, I believe. But as it turns out, that was the exact bottom and the tokens picked up. So it was peak FUD around the unlock. And Optimism does have its Bedrock upgrade that's slated for June 6th, so just 4 days from now. So I guess that's kind of balancing out the, you know, negative sentiment around the unlocks. And so far, I haven't seen anyone really dumping their tokens en masse, like in terms of investors or team members or whatnot. So.
Oh, interesting. So people were selling ahead of the unlock, thinking that vesting would, you know, that people would sell their vested tokens, but that didn't really happen.
Yeah, or it hasn't happened yet, at least. Yeah. So it's bounced, it's staged a decent bounce, about 5-6% off the lows. So.
Interesting.
And there are a few more unlocks set to come in this week as well, some major ones. And this is always like the reason we highlighted this in a story, actually, because it's something that, you know, every investor should be aware of. These token unlocks, most, even though we're in a bear market, most of these unlocks are happening for investors who invested really early. So they're still in the money, right? So like in Optimism's case, I believe most of the tokens were bought in the 30 cent range. So even though like it's down 50% from the highs, early investors are still up 5, 6, 7x. So that gives people incentives to, you know, book profits and move on, right? To the next opportunity. So, you know, it's always advisable to keep an eye on sites like token unlocks, especially when it comes to stuff that you're holding.
Right. What are some of the unlocks coming up this this week? Like Sui, I think. We had this on our.
Yeah, Sui, 1inch, HBAR as well, I think, and DYDX. DYDX, if you guys will remember, had a massive unlock that was supposed to come in late last year. I think it was December or so. And there was huge FUD going into it, right? The same way. And the token tanked and everything. And then they decided to delay the unlock by a year. And the token went from, I think, 60 cents to $2.50.
Yes.
So, you can see just how these token supply mechanics, you know, play into the price, and more than price, it's, I think it just plays on sentiment, you know.
Yeah, I guess so. We'll see if these unlocks are kind of sell the rumor kind of events, or if they actually do impact in the price after they happen. But wasn't the case for Optimism? That's, I mean, not yet. So that's really interesting.
And certainly there are going to be people standing on the sidelines when those tokens dump, you know, ready to buy them back. You know, that's the nature of these markets. It happens. You see that bounce.
Yeah. Okay. And then, Jeremy, you your first story on the Defiant. You reported on the latest for multi-chain. So you want to catch us up on that?
Let's look at multi-chain. Multi-chain capital is this large, billion-dollar bridge that, exists between many different blockchains, about 92, as a matter of fact. But as a decentralized network, it did have a single point of failure, as it would turn out. The CEO had permissions to manage certain servers, and as a result of his absence now for over a week, I believe, and rumors circulating of his potential arrest by Chinese authorities, it's caused a lot of speculation with regards to multi-chain. As a matter of fact, the server that he was supposed to manage went down or was basically needed service. And as a result, many of the services for the chains that were connected to multi-chain stopped functioning. Now, some people had their transactions held up for over a week. In the case of Corium, they decided to burn the tokens and launch a custodial solution that moved away from utilizing the bridge. Multi-chain has said that they have not had contact with their CEO now in public a couple days ago, and they've deprecated support for a number of the chains that were affected by the server. This begs a question, how can a decentralized service operate if it has these types of single points of failure? And many of the experts that I've spoken to in the field have said that this is a reminder that regardless of, what we build inside the code, we have to have an infrastructure in terms of the human resources that manage these types of platforms in order to avoid these types of things. It goes against the very ethos of the blockchain ecosystem to have a decentralized infrastructure that can then have this bottleneck in a single person that has the potential to tank it. Now, another thing that was brought up is if this individual, the CEO or anyone that has a significant influence over a protocol like this is taken into custody, can they be coerced to do something negative to the protocol? Mm-hmm. We've seen in inaction how this can affect marketplaces. People have been offboarding liquidity from the bridge to a certain extent. But what if he did something malicious? Now, I'm not saying he would. And there is a lot of unknowns here, so I won't go out and say we know what's going on here, but I would say that in a hypothetical, an individual that has the capacity to do harm to a system based on their access level, that should not exist, specifically within the ecosystem where so much onus has been put on the idea that we're building infrastructures that are trustless, that are decentralized, that do not have these points of failure, that have fail-safes. So I'm curious to see how the lessons will be learned from the situation. We've seen a lot of big, big shocks to the industry over the past year and a half with, Terra Luna, FTX. If a large multi-chain bridge goes down with billions of dollars or $1.4 billion right now locked in value in it, it's going to be a significant setback. And people who are looking at this from the standpoint of like, how do I deploy capital here and these chains are going to be trying to figure out ways to do it without utilizing bridges. And right now there is not a lot of cross-chain connectivity for the direct, custody. And when you look at a bridge, you've got an issuer on one hand. So they take your token and wrap it. So they're custodying your token, okay? And then they're using it as a collateral for another bridge. So if they're both the issuer and providing the collateral for custody, if something happens to that bridge, not only are the tokens that you're using on the one where you, like your collateral is gone and your wrap token is gone. So it's a big lose-lose situation in cases where this happens. And it's difficult to say what the future holds for multi-chain, but right now people are very nervous and hoping to find, some news on how they're going to move forward. They must rapidly address this.
Yeah. I think, it's a really important lesson for the industry as a whole, that it's really unacceptable when you're dealing with people's money to have just centralized points of failure and just risky practices like we're seeing here with this bridge where, a single person missing can cause outages and disruption to services to like a dozen chains and put $1 billion at risk. So, I think bridges have continued to be this
this weak spot for the entire blockchain industry. Like, we've seen hack after hack, and it's a shame because, like, there is this vision of a multi-chain future where you're able to, like, hop from one chain to another, but that really does rely on bridges being safe, and, you know, and they, time and time again, it looks like they're not. So one thing can come out of this is just, like you said, just better practices for security, using, I don't know, like, multi-sig, having a few people with control over servers, and like all the different pieces that are needed to secure people's funds.
Yeah, it's really a shame too. I mean, the architecture of these bridges would seem to me to be chief of importance when it comes to this. And I think that because of the necessity, like, interoperability has been a hot point issue for many years now. So because of the necessity, they're building towards interoperability, but they're not necessarily building towards it in a way that has fidelity. And so now we're seeing some of the results of that, the consequences.
Yeah. Kind of goes back to what, you know, Pete Rizzo was saying. And it just makes this almost like maximalist narrative, you know, it makes their point stronger because, you know, if you think this like multi-chain future isn't really viable, then, you know, either like Bitcoin maxis or Ethereum maxis or like Solana maxis are gonna say, let's just like have everything on one chain, because like having multiple chains and having to like go from one chain to another just like isn't safe, unless you're doing it like via a centralized exchange. I mean, that's an option, but you know, if you want to go full non-custodial, then.
And like,
I mean,
when we
are building, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I'll just say it. When we see the traditional finance world too, we have like, you know, institutions that bail out these entities when we see instability or fragility in the banking sector. You know, the government comes and writes them a check, and that's how that works. That's the FDIC insurance. We have these bridges between things, and like in the traditional finance world, we're given this sentiment, hey, having a diverse portfolio is safer. It's good for you. But here it's almost the opposite, right? Because having a diverse portfolio, unless you have like set up custody for all those different blockchains, especially if you're a traditional finance person, you're not going to want to do that. You're going to want to go through some type of regulated access terminal. So these bridges allow you to deploy capital across like a swath of blockchains, right? But then the maximalist will come back and tell you, well, that flies in the face of what's logical, because in traditional finance, yes, having a diversity among assets is smart, but in the blockchain sense, you might be putting yourself at risk because you're using a bridge that's actually a central point of failure. So while you think that you're bulwarking your assets by diversifying them, in actuality, you're putting them all in one basket, because the provider for that service that you're diversifying through is that central point of failure in the case of this bridge.
Right.
Yeah, I think we're developing more interesting solutions that don't require custodial bridges, like, you know, layer zero and, you know, things like that, which actually do like the whole, burn and mint mechanism. So it's the same asset that's moved to the chain. So I think that would kind of, that's a step forward, at least. I mean, multi-chain, I mean, we can see what happened with Solana when FTX collapsed, right? So you had Solana, ETH, and Sol Bitcoin, which was custodied or supposed to be by FTX. The collateral was gone, the tokens depegged, and the entire DeFi ecosystem on Solana collapsed, because, you know, if you don't have accurate price for Bitcoin and ETH or, you know, Sol, what do you do? Right? Like, all your lending protocols would be left with bad debt, and like, it was a complete mess.
Yeah. And, you know, lack of good pricing oracles, we've seen time and time again. You want to do a flash attack? That's how you do it. You find a pricing oracle, you make it so that the price is off, and then you go to the service that's using that oracle, and you buy tokens on one end and sell them on the other, and then you laugh all the way to the tornado mixer.
To Tornado Cash, except that it's been exploited, as we reported last week.
It's not Tornado. Yeah. Tornado Cyclone. I just made that up. I don't know.
That transitions really nicely into this other story we did on Dan Ilitzer's prediction that there will be an Oracle-free DeFi emerging. So Danny Litzer, co-founder of Nascent VC, he was previously at IDO. He was also behind Yam Finance, for those of you DeFi veterans out there who remember that those days. So, you know, he's a real DeFi OG, and he's seeing this new trend emerge, which is, speaking of the risk of oracles, he's saying that he's seeing more and more DeFi protocols building without building their own oracle inside of the protocol, but just, you know, using existing pieces like Chainlink and other kind of trusted parties instead, just to, you know, make these protocols more robust. And not just oracles, but he's also, you know, highlighting how governance needs to be minimized, because that's also been another point of failure for DeFi and an attack vector for crypto. I mean, we've seen time and time again how governance has been exploited to, you know, I mean, we just mentioned Tornado Cash. That's how the attack on Tornado Cash happened. Yeah. He passed a governance proposal that allowed him to just, you know, steal money from the protocol, essentially. So yeah, Dan here is saying for DeFi to be more secure, we need to minimize reliance on both oracles and governance. So, you know, maybe we'll see more streamlined DeFi protocols in the future that are, you know, very efficient and don't require that are just like made to work on the thing that they're made to do. So if it's a lending protocol, it just does that, just that. If it's a DEX, it, you know, smart contracts are running to do just, you know, swaps, and without, you know, layering risks of governance of oracles on top of these protocols. Is kind of his prediction, or what he's seeing will emerge. And there are a couple of examples of this happening. So we have that. What did we mention? I think Blur was one of like Oracle and like governance minimized, and there's been kind of a couple of other examples emerging of this model. So I definitely see his point. So we'll see. And then just, you know, going through other DeFi news, Curve launched its stablecoin, and it's been performing really well, trading within 0.5% of its range in the first month. And, you know, compared with much wider fluctuations with other stablecoins when they launched. So DAI fluctuated within 8%, FRAX by 10%. And SUSD USD by 2%. So by comparison, Curve's stablecoin has performed really well. There's been 4.7 million of CRV USD minted in its first month. That puts it in the 42nd place in terms of size. So still small, but, you know, it's only been 1 month. And what's cool about this stablecoin, it has a real kind of novel mechanism for keeping collateral and keeping the peg. It's called Llama liquidations. So what it does is it's a mechanism that when your collateral is coming against the threshold, the protocol will convert it into stablecoins instead of unwinding the entire position and get you liquidated. So I thought that was super novel and just feels a bit safer than other stablecoin designs. So
that is interesting.
Something to keep an eye on. Right now it can only be minted against Frax's liquid staking token. So a bit limited in terms of liquidity, but it's looking to add other liquid staking tokens as collateral with time. So
I think Llama is really cool in terms of soft liquidation is always much nicer when you're borrowing, you know, given the volatility of crypto markets. You don't want to be taken out on just one spike down and, you know, your collateral's gone and you watch the market bounce back and you're like, ah, you know, I wish I hadn't been so leveraged. But this actually is an ingenious solution because it kind of dollar cost averages you in and out of your position as it's going for or against you. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a lot more user-friendly or rather beginner trader-friendly. I mean, a lot of people love DeFi, but they're not good traders. So they end up like over-leveraging themselves and saying, all right, you know, like to the moon. And then, you know, one speech from Jerome Powell or something and boom, position's gone. And so I think this will be like the concept is really cool. And I hope more protocols kind of build on top of that. I mean, lending protocols could potentially use a similar algorithm too, right? In terms of dealing with the liquidations and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's small still because it only has like this one type of collateral, but you know, it's a matter of time, I think, before they just, you know, add more types of collateral and it becomes a more liquid and bigger stablecoin. Because yeah, like you were saying, that this mechanism really does make a lot of sense. So it's good to see more innovation in DeFi again. Like we had been, I think, kind of stagnating for a while, but I think it looks like things are picking up. And then as I mentioned in the, earlier, interesting to see there's been a record number of traders or at least wallets interacting with Uniswap in May. This is, of course, driven by Memecoin mania. You know, Uniswap V2 especially is the place where people go to buy and sell these meme coins. Interestingly, the Uni price hasn't really, you know, risen because of this. There's been no impact to it. It's continued to underperform ETH. And that's been the case for most DeFi blue chip tokens. It's actually a theme that we're exploring to see why that's the case. I mean, DeFi tokens just continue to underperform ETH, even if they're doing well, like Uniswap is. We have this Polygon onboarding Deutsche Telekom as a validator. Polygon just is such a beast. They just continue like adding. Integrating all these huge big name alliances. So here's another one. Jeremy, I don't like. I'm not sure what Deutsche Telekom will do as a validator. Didn't get a chance to look at this in a lot of depth.
So they're going to be a validator on the existing proof of stake chain. And also provide validation and staking services for Polygon Supernets, which is another, it's a layer three solution that they've been developing that's for institutional use and whatnot. So, I mean, Polygon now has, like Sam mentioned, there are like four or five different blockchains, projects, scaling solutions that they're building. So, yeah, like you said, I have no idea how they managed to pull all these
it's incredible.
Crazy partnerships. I mean, if you're not familiar with crypto at all, you'd probably think Polygon's the only blockchain that exists, given you know all the announcements that comes out. Starbucks, you know, like pretty much any company you think of, yes, it's a Polygon partnership, which I really don't know how they do it.
Yeah, I mean, their BD team is like golden. We actually have a podcast with their head of BD, so you guys should go check that out.
I said, we'll pick his brain. We'll find out the secret sauce.
Yes, yes. I think we should wrap things up. But while I see, let's get this drama from Moonbirds as kind of the cherry on top of this recap.
Oh wow! I mean, this was. I mean, I've followed the project, never actually minted or traded or bought any of the proof NFTs, but I've been following them closely since they launched, essentially, because at the time, you know, it was peak bull. You know, proof passes had crossed 100 ETH. Bored Apes were crossing 100 ETH as well on their way to like 150. ETH was still above 3K, and we still had the hope that, you know, it's just a correction. But of course, you know, Terra collapsed a month later and everything changed. But coming back to Moonbirds, so I think what he was trying to do was quite good in terms of trying to address the FUD from the community. And like, he basically put out a tweet saying, you know, what's your FUD? Like, give it to me, right? And after that, this was the space that happened on Monday. And it was an hour-long space, and he said a lot about, you know, the future of proof and the collections and whatnot. But what everyone latched onto was this one comment that he made, which was that he had done the math, and that somehow people who had bought Bored Apes at the peak, you know, 150 ETH or whatnot, were down worse in dollar terms than people holding Moonbirds, which is, to be quite honest, an absurd comparison, because not only are Moonbirds trading below their mint price, while Bored Apes are like still 500x above theirs, but Bored Apes got a ton of freebies in terms of value along the way, right? They got, first they started off with Mutant Apes, then the dogs, or I'm not sure whether the dogs came first or the mutants, but and then you had, you know, the Ape Token, Other Side Land, these Dookie Dash passes.
Not to mention, like, if you have a Bored Ape, it generates a certain amount of ape coin per month.
Yep, ape staking as well, yeah.
Yep.
So everyone descended on him essentially and said, you know, what have you been smoking? Like, this makes no sense whatsoever, right? And so I actually reached out to a few community members who've been there since the beginning, like who've minted and held their birds and round-tripped it all the way back. So they went from... The mint was at 2.5 ETH, which was $7,500 or so at the time. They sold out immediately and, you know, flew to a floor of 40 ETH in a week, right? So that was 120K bird that people held on to. And now, yeah, I think they're trading around 2 ETH. So that's 50% off mint price as well, if you factor in the drop in ETH as well.
Yeah.
And I think... this picture actually summarizes it the best in terms of, you know, how everything went down. It was just a series of, I think, missteps, bad communication from the team. Primarily, the biggest one, I think, was the surprise switch to Creative Commons licensing, which basically makes your NFT open source and, you know, in the public domain. And this happened at a time when, you know, Nouns and projects that had embraced CC0 were doing really well. And I think, you know, this is speculation on my part, but I feel like, you know, the attention had gone off Moonbirds at the time. And, you know, it's possible that, you know, Kevin Rose and the team just felt, you know, they have to do something to kind of bring the attention back. But this, I don't think, was the way to do it, because it really destroyed, you know, everyone I spoke to pointed at that move as, you know, having destroyed the trust of the holders. One holder was apparently working on a six-figure licensing deal for his Moonbird, which fell apart when this thing was announced out of the blue. But that particular holder is still in the community, and I actually saw that he thinks that it's a good entry price at 2 ETH. So he's still sticking around, which goes to show that there are still people believing in the project and in, you know, Kevin Rose's ability to build companies and, you know, his track record and whatnot. So I guess we'll just have to see, you know, how it plays out.
You know, with a lot.
And as you pointed out. Sorry, Jeremy, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that, as you pointed out, what we see, there have been examples of NFT projects that did, you know, turn around, were able to come back from what appeared to be just, you know, failings.
Absolutely. I mean, even Pixelmon is on its way back. So if they can do it, anything's possible.
Yeah, it's just, so you never know.
Oh, what's going to happen with NFTs? You know, like, there are a lot of factors there. It's not just the art. It's, you know, what utility is being put into this, what value is being driven back to the people that minted this thing in the beginning, and then what are they developing on top of it? You know, we've seen a lot of very high profile NFT collections out there forging real world activations, creating token gated merchandise. You know, it just depends on how people want to buy into it. You know, a lot of this stuff that they're doing exists outside the NFT ecosystem without any token gating. So are they really necessarily innovating and doing something new? It remains to be seen.
Yeah. Speaking of doodles, they actually came out with a similar, well, they've announced it, it's not out yet, but a similar kind of physical experience as, I guess they've seen that Penguins did really well.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, there is the Doodles and Camp collab, right? That came out a couple of days ago. Yeah. But again, they've come out and said they're not an NFT company anymore. So I don't know what their plans are.
I can't really get too deep in the comments on the Doodles. As a member of that ecosystem for a long time, I will just say people in Doodles want to see it succeed and want to see that team do something that drives value back to OGs.
For sure.
I think every NFT project wants that, right? Like every NFT community wants that, especially the ones that raised like ridiculous amounts of money. I think Doodles raised at what, 700 million valuation or something like that?
Yeah, with 776's capital infusion.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I think, you know, this will be the moment where we see what actual utility NFT projects have beyond just the hype, you know. Now that, you know, the top of the market is gone, like that all of the hype has cooled down, they have to actually deliver. And so, you know, this is the time where you really see, you know, was there something there, or, you know, was it just an opportunistic way of, you know, taking advantage of all the NFT mania that happened in the past, you know, couple of years. So yeah, this is a time where these communities will have to prove themselves, or these teams will have to prove themselves. So we shall see. I think there will be just like a few that actually succeed. I don't know, see all of the thousands of collections, or I don't know how many actually making it.
Well, I mean, we've been fed this whole notion of a metaverse, right? And that these digital assets will kind of like coexist somewhere in this cross-platform interoperable ecosystem, and it just hasn't manifested yet. And part of the reason for that is because there isn't a necessity for such a thing. There isn't a physical world that we could like put on a pair of goggles and have a film of AR around us right now. It just, we're not there with technology. So this notion of a metaverse, it doesn't cohesively exist with our reality. Metaverse and like the NFT ecosystem is built around like this future development type of thing, and I think because they're so focused on the future, a lot of people in the meantime have been waiting for something to happen, and a lot of teams have fallen short on communication, on delivering real products, and on doing anything aside from just iterating in the same space and regurgitating the same thing over and over again. And that's why we have 10,000 different PFP projects popping up every 5 minutes. So it goes back to the partnerships that they've built, the innovation that they're doing in the ecosystem, and then the community and activating in the community and the value that they're building in that community. So like Moonbirds had this community of people that were ostensibly driving it, especially when they had all that negative press with regards to the, you know, the fanny packs, the socks, the SVB thing, you know. The people that were holding up that project were the community, the people that were saying, hey, I'm going to hold this because I believe in it, you know, and I believe in what we're doing. And the same can be said for a lot of other projects out there. So it gets difficult because these communities, if the community is just sitting there hoping and the people who are managing that community are just sitting there riding on the coattails of that hope, eventually you're going to see that there's a limitation there. It's not sustainable.
For sure.
Yeah.
And so, on that note, we can wrap up and say that our community is well served. We keep delivering value every single day. So thank you guys for sticking around. Remember to subscribe to our newsletters, our podcast, our YouTube channel. Give us a like so the algorithm gods like us more.
And yeah, and catch us next week with another weekly recap. Thanks everyone for joining.
We'll see you again.